Ask Dr. Dawn is produced by Jiva Media at the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn, an hour-long question and answer debate, dialogue, and discussion featuring you. All you'll need to do is call in and ask your questions. We're live on the air, and I hope you'll stay tuned here on KUSP. But before we go any further, alas, a few housekeeping items. The opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. All of that being said, let's take a deep breath and launch right into the show. Well, last week's show, we talked with a doctor who had a medical marijuana practice, and we took some questions on the air. I hope you all enjoyed that. I found it very instructive. This is an old news clipping that I hadn't used, and I just thought I'd share with you where to look for some of that research on cannabinoids. There's a researcher at Stanford named Huguenard, H-U-G-U-E-N-A-R-D, and I think if you go into Grateful Med or one of the internet search engines and search Huguenard at Stanford, you'll get research on the cannabinoids. Now, one of the things that came up last week was the idea that our brains have receptors for cannabis-like drugs and that these serve a purpose in the brain. And in fact, not just the brain, but also the gut and the heart and other parts of the body actually seem to have cannabinoid receptors. But in terms of exactly what they're doing in the brain, I thought that Huguenard's research was very interesting. Now, they're doing rat brain cells and electrical current and then measuring the output of brain tissue. But they're doing this. This is definitely basic science. What they do find, though, is that the cannabinoid's purpose in the brain is a sedative. Now, nerve cells are, particularly in the brain, but in general, nerve cells have a basic rate that they fire, kind of what's called a tonic rate. And then there will be inputs from other nerve cells onto the front end of that nerve cell that speed up that rate or slow it down. So you can think of, say, something that's beating in 4-4 time, and you can speed it up with another nerve cell, slow it down with yet another nerve cell. And it's the balance of stimulation and inhibition that determine what that actual rate is going to be. Now, it gets even more fun. The cell that the nerve cell is stimulating actually has a feedback loop. And so if that cell is feeling that it's getting too much input, it can actually send a signal upstream to the other nerve cell and say, you know, slow down, guy. You're giving me stuff too fast to process. And that's where the cannabinoids come in. They create, they're an inhibitory influence on cells. But most important about Huguenard's research is that the cell that gets inhibited is actually generally a filter. So its job is to thin out the information that's being transmitted and filter it. When you inhibit a filter, then what you get is a stimulatory effect. You flood the nerve cell downstream with more input. And in this case, we're talking about sensory information that it would affect perception, memory, movement, and mood. So the cannabinoids, in Huguenard's research at least, have their major influence in terms of how our brain processes incoming information and also associational things like the emotions and the memories that are evoked by incoming information. And so it loosens a natural filter, and the neurons tend to be flooded and they tend to bounce around. This affects focus, of course. Now let's think about other diseases of focus, like perhaps ADD. I thought it was very interesting that our guest said that some people with ADD find it helpful to use cannabinoids. That seems a little counterintuitive, but now that you understand the complex web that we're talking about when we talk about nerve cells, maybe it's not so counterintuitive after all. Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Dominican Hospital Foundation, partnering with the community to meet the healthcare needs of Santa Cruz County. Information online at DominicanHospital.org or by phone 831-462-7712. The Community Advisory Board of KUSP and the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation meets regularly, and the public is invited to attend. The June meeting is on Monday evening beginning at 6:30 p.m. at West Marine Support Center Conference Room, 500 Westridge Drive in Watsonville. Call the station during business hours for more information. Our numbers are 476-2800 or 800-655-5877. And indeed, we are at those numbers, and I'd love to talk with you. Okay, our top story for today, you knew it in your heart. You knew that it was probably true. Now it's official. Road rage is, in fact, now an official mental illness. This from the Archives of General Psychiatry. This is the June issue. And you'll be glad to know that there is a new diagnosis for this. Road rage is being identified as a new disorder. And let's see, what are they exactly calling it? No, it's funny, they don't actually give an official name here, but it's going to be intermittent explosive disorder or something along those lines. And I'm sorry, docs, we don't have the code, but if we did decide to code this as a diagnosis, we'd be coding up to 16 million Americans. This is a situation where people have road rage, temper outbursts that involve throwing or breaking objects, and sometimes even spousal abuse. And people who are affected by it have multiple outbursts that are way out of proportion to the situation. These outbursts often include threats or aggressive actions, even property damage. The disorder typically begins in adolescence. The average age of onset is 14. There's a strong, are you surprised, male-to-female bias in this. And there's thinking about 5 to 7% of the population has this. This makes it more common than schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So intermittent explosive disorder, the new diagnosis du jour in the ICDM, and one that I can certainly think of a few people I know that might be suffering from it. Now, of course, just you wait. There'll be a drug coming down the pike just for this with a new FDA indication. I think probably one of the SSRIs, if not several of the SSRIs, will go after this one. Remember those cute commercials that Paxil did a few years ago for social anxiety disorder? In other words, pathologic shyness? Well, I think we can expect the intermittent explosive disorder commercial coming down the pike should be amusing. Let's go now to David in Santa Cruz. Hello, David, and welcome to the show.
Hello. See, on March 3rd, I had an episode of congestive heart failure.
Uh-huh.
So that was in the hospital for about 30 hours, and they changed my medicines and took a bunch of tests, et cetera.
How old are you?
76.
And had you had high blood pressure or a heart attack in the past?
No heart attacks, no. I have high blood pressure, though.
Okay. Go ahead.
What I was interested in was this test they give you when you're in the emergency room, BNP.
BNP, yes.
He's a boy, BNP.
Brain Natriuretic Peptide is what it stands for.
Right. Uh-huh. And I guess I looked it up on the computer, and it said that if it's above 100 in the clinic, then it's indication of congestive heart failure.
Yes.
So there was up to 1440.
That's a very high number.
And what I was interested in now is where I go for medical help is continuing to measure the BNP levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, and even 2 weeks ago, it's in the range of 600 to 800. So I wonder if there's any significance to BNP level, staying at that level.
Yeah, I think there is, but because it's a relatively new test, we haven't had enough experience to be able to understand everything we need to know about interpreting it as a monitoring test. BNP came around about 5 years ago, I think, is when it was first starting to be developed. And it was a useful test, and I'll explain why in a minute. But it was useful for telling us, are we dealing with congestive heart failure, or are we dealing with a primary lung problem? Is this a... because a lot of the symptoms can overlap, and it can be difficult to tell whether it's whether you have a problem because there's something wrong with the kidneys, there's something wrong with the lungs, or there's something wrong with the heart, since they can manifest with similar symptoms, right? Swelling in the legs, shortness of breath, some extra noises in the lungs when you listen with your stethoscope. So it's a useful test because it's a chemical signal that's actually... there's several natriuretic peptides, brain natriuretic peptide. There's one called atrial natriuretic peptide. And natriuretic means, it has nothing to do with natural, it has to do with salt. Natrium, I think, is the root word, and it's the word for salt in either Greek or Latin, and you'll forgive me if I don't remember which. But the idea is the balance of water and salt in the body is key to functioning. And when we're not sure what's going on, we check a BNP. If it's elevated, that tells us that we have an element of heart failure and that we need to treat this person with diuretics and things that will cause their heart to beat a little bit more strongly. Now, why is the heart not beating well in the first place? And the answer to that is that, first of all, there's a complex communication going on between the blood pressure and the kidney. I'm going to try to walk you through this and make it make sense. So stay with me on this, okay?
Okay.
All right. Your kidney has a blood pressure sensor. And in primitive times, when the blood pressure dropped, there are usually two reasons for that. You're either not getting enough water or you're bleeding. And so the kidney, when it senses a drop in the blood pressure, wants to hold on to water. So it changes it, so it stops peeing. It starts concentrating the urine. It starts holding on to fluid to raise the blood pressure. Now, in heart failure, what's happened is the heart pump has become weakened, either because, in the case of high blood pressure, it may have been working extra hard to pump against a pressure head, to get pump against resistance, and eventually it stops being able to do that. There's an optimum amount of stretch for the heart where you get your best contraction. If you stretch the heart further than that because you're filling it with extra fluid, there's a point where you don't where the contraction force actually starts to drop off, and that's heart failure. So in the case of this, we've got a wrong action happening. The kidney thinks, oh, blood pressure's dropped, I'm going to hold on to fluid. Well, that extra fluid gets into the heart and stretches it beyond the sweet spot. So now the contraction, which wasn't good, because that's why the blood pressure dropped, right? The heart wasn't pumping well. Now we add more fluid to the heart, and the heart pumps even less well, which drops the blood pressure, which causes the kidney to hang on to more fluid, and you're in a bad feedback loop.
Yeah.
So when you see brain natriuretic peptide being high, that's a hang-on-to-salt signal, and hang-on-to-salt signals are to hold on to fluid, because water follows salt, basic principle of renal physiology, or you know, fluid dynamics in the body. Water follows salt, more water. So when you want to get rid of water, you lose salt, and the water follows the salt out into the sewage system. That's why we use diuretics in heart failure, to get rid of that extra backed up fluid. So I always think of BNP as being useful when I'm trying to figure out why the lungs are full of fluid. Is it a lung problem? Is it a heart problem? Or is it a kidney problem? And BNP being elevated says this is a heart problem. This is heart failure. I don't have enough clinical experience using it as a indicator for progress in a patient. When I'm seeing my heart failure patients in the clinic, I'm not using it. The cardiologists, I think, are blazing the trail there and trying to figure out how do we use this? If it's dropping, it's good. But in terms of giving you an absolute score, I don't think the data's there yet to use the score. And, you know, as long as it's going down, that's good. That means that your treatment is reversing your heart failure, and that's what you want to see. But I don't think that anybody has the right number beyond, once you're above normal. You know, the lower the better is basically the principle I would apply here.
Yeah, maybe some point in people's lives, they ought to get a baseline for that number.
Well, Well, the baseline should be under 100. That's, we know what normal is.
Oh, I see. You do know that. Okay.
Yeah, we know that. But what, and we know it goes up when you're dealing with heart failure. Sometimes someone will come in, let's say they have a different reason for fluid in the lungs, an infection or something like that.
Yeah.
It can look like heart failure. And you'll check a BNP and it's normal. It's like, okay, well, now we've got shock lung, or we've got hantavirus, or we've got, you know, some other entity that's mimicking heart failure, and we know to look elsewhere. Heart failure being so common, you don't want to jump to the conclusion it's heart failure. So it's a confirmatory test.
Yeah.
But I think in your situation, I want to throw out two other things about heart failure. Very, very strong data for ACE inhibitors, which are drugs, or ARBs, two different classes of blood pressure medications. And they help break that feedback loop that I talked about, where the kidney senses the low blood pressure and takes measures to increase the fluid volume.
Right.
Both of those categories of drugs, you need to be on that if you have heart failure or know the reason why. You need a good reason not to be on those drugs. And another thing, which doesn't make a lot of sense intuitively, but it's in fact counterintuitive, which is why it took so long for doctors to do it, is beta blockers, which can actually cause heart failure. You would think they could cause heart failure based on their pharmacological actions anyway. When you give them to people in heart failure, they actually improve their outcome, particularly reducing their chances of arrhythmias and sudden death. So again, people who have heart failure should be on ACE inhibitors and low-dose beta blockers, or there should be a good reason why they are not on those drugs. So
yes, I'm on all that stuff.
Good, good. Then you've got a good doctor.
And I didn't tell you one thing, though. I have a atrial flutter, I think it is, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has started up about 6 years ago. And
atrial flutter, like atrial fibrillation, is going to subtract about 15% of your heart's power. And so if you're doing that in a setting of heart failure, that absolutely does weaken the situation further.
Yeah, I did have all those symptoms you mentioned.
Yeah, well.
The first time I showed up with that, they corrected with electrocardioversion, but now they don't do that anymore. They just put me on Coumadin.
Yeah, David, any further questions? Because we have some other callers waiting.
Okay, no, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Anthony in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. This is Anthony, actually a colleague of yours in the field of acupuncture and health services. And I had a question for you about this study on the intermittent explosive disorder. I was very intrigued when I heard about this a couple days ago on National Public Radio, because it's something that I felt for a long time has been missing in our differential diagnosis of depression and mental health condition. And what I was curious about is whether the article comments at all on social dimensions of it. As you suggested, there's probably going to be drugs coming out for it, but it struck me for a while that I think there's a cultural blind spot we have with regard to the venting of anger and aggressive behavior. And this was brought home to me. I was watching a French movie. Oh, I don't know if must have been about a 10 or 15-year-old movie, and they were using a term I'd never heard before. It was kind of a psychological drama. The term was hostile depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it described, I think, very well what sounds like this intermittent explosive disorder is being described as. And I'm wondering whether you can comment on, or whether the article comments on, perhaps changing our social norms or social standards to recognize more and more that this is a mental illness that you know, deserves diagnosis and treatment, that perhaps deserves special, you know, counseling or other sort of social forms and cultural forms of remedy, rather than just going straight to a pharmaceutical solution. Is that addressed at all in the article, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's not addressed in the article. In general, when they do these articles, they try to avoid getting into the sociology of things. You know, they're trying to, they're splitters rather than lumpers, and so they aren't holistic thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a description of it. It's more of a description and an assessment and the validation of a questionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
But Let's talk about this. I have a lot of experience going to Indonesia, Bali in particular, which is a place I love to visit, and I've had lots of opportunity now over the many year times I've been there, and speaking with friends and, you know, developing a sense for the culture. I've had chances to watch that manifestation, because travel's frustrating, and, you know, things get screwed up and you have to wait, and it's a great opportunity to trigger these explosive outbursts in others. And I always have this disjunct when I've been in Bali. You just don't behave that way in that culture. And it is, oddly enough, there is a cultural entity where, first of all, people don't do it. They don't blow off steam like this. They don't have these eruptions. But there is a different cultural entity that we don't have, which is called going amok or running amok. And that actually has entered into English. But every now and then, people lose it completely and become murderously rageful and run around on a rampage. And this is understood to be a rare but not completely unheard of decompensation of this, probably the same disorder. And it's basically people keep a lid on it because it's culturally appropriate to keep a lid on it. And they keep a lid on it. They're taught to do that. They're taught to do that at all costs. And basically when they lose the ability to do that, when they totally do decompensate, it erupts in an even larger and more destructive way. So I just think that it's probably impossible to completely fix this, even with very powerful social disapproval and taboos, which is how they do it in Bali. You just don't do this, and it's at the level of squatting down and defecating on a public street. You just don't do it. The level of inhibition is much too high for anyone to do it. Until they become so overwhelmed by the pressure, the internal pressure, that it erupts like a volcano.
Right.
Now, you, I know, have a great deal of traditional Chinese medicine knowledge. So share with us what you think the TCM diagnosis, or what's going on qi-wise in this, I presume this is a rising liver fire
sort of
thing. So talk about that for a minute. Let's share with us some of your expertise.
Well, I guess from the standpoint of traditional Chinese medicine, you know, my understanding, without having read the article on intermittent explosive disorder.
But we've all seen this. I mean, we know what it is.
As you say, a sort of a upward flaring of liver fire, or gan huo in Chinese, which is actually where our term gung ho comes from.
Really?
And it's kind of interesting that in Chinese medicine, gan huo is considered a pathology, for us in the U.S., gung ho is kind of the term we use as, you know, to describe soldiers going into battle and various, you know, sort of positive attributes.
Well, it's sort of, so, yeah, it's contextual, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's also in Chinese medicine a concept of phlegm fire, which the phlegm, you know, disturbing the functions of the mind to the point where it can no longer, see clearly what's appropriate and how to handle things, but it becomes chaotic and disorganized. But there are positive ways to, you know, anger by itself is not necessarily a bad thing. It's how we handle it and how it's channeled and how it's expressed that makes it either constructive in terms of the drive to right wrongs and to you know, fix problems versus just explosive destructive rage. Mm-hmm. But it just seems to me that treating it as a isolated mental pathology without putting it in social context, in some sense, runs the risk of replicating the roots of the illness of inadequate or dysfunctional mechanisms for dealing with anger.
I think you're absolutely right.
And that, you know, that in addition to, you know, just as with depression, acute intervention with pharmaceuticals is sometimes necessary to stave off suicide or, you know, very self-destructive acts. I'm not saying there isn't a role for pharmaceuticals, but it seems like this should be for us, not just as healthcare providers, but as patients ourselves and as this culture or society, to revisit the question of how do we handle anger.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know what the article says, whether it narrowly defines it as anger behind the wheel of an automobile, but as a frequent bike commuter, I feel like I've observed on a frequent basis and been threatened with quite often is drivers who just, you know, even when they're not threatened, see the power that they have behind the wheel of an automobile as some kind of license to abuse others and act aggressively. And you know, we have a lot of very hostile bumper stickers out there. People, the 1-800, you know, eat my medication, you know, variety of bumper
stickers.
Hey, this
is a family show. Watch it.
You never see stuff like that in Europe, for example. You don't see hostile, angry bumper stickers like that.
That's true. Okay, well, let me just throw out one more thing. I agree with you completely. When I was about 20 years ago, when I was training down in San Bernardino, they had a really interesting intervention program. It was anger management for men. And if you got arrested and were on probation for some sort of manifestation of explosive, intermittent explosive disorder, like you beat up your wife, you beat up a guy at the bar, whatever, you get the idea. You broke a window because you were upset about not getting your refund, and you ended up on probation. You had to take this course as a condition of your probation, and in it, the psychologists who were teaching it basically taught how to change. They were using martial arts techniques, as near as I can tell, which had to do with, you know, breathing and refocusing energy and, you know, doing some very chi-oriented kinds of interventions with the idea that, you know, you don't have to take a drug, you don't have to take a Valium. It's, you know, you want to learn how to direct this energy. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that this would be a useful thing for us to consider. How do we teach children? And I'd be very interested, perhaps you know some people and could put them in touch with me, but I'd be very interested in thinking about how do we teach this when they're young? How do we construct a children's curriculum that maybe we could get some volunteers to go around to the local schools and do it as a pilot project?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you're young, you pick this stuff up quickly, you don't question it, you develop these skills rapidly, and we might really help people who will go on as adults to develop this disorder. 5-7% of the population means in any grade school class, you're going to have 2 or 3 kids with this.
Yeah.
So why aren't we trying to proactively teach these skills? And I'm just very interested in the idea. I'm going to go ahead and move on with the show, but thank you very much for your call, and let's continue the dialogue.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. I appreciate your bringing this up on the air.
Bye-bye, Anthony.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Well Within Spa. Well Within offers massage therapy, face and body care, and private spa rooms overlooking a Japanese garden in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is available at Well Within Spa, 458 WELL, and online at wellwithinspa.com. Every week, KUSP's Film Gang looks at movies playing in Central Coast theaters. From the Hollywood blockbusters to the offbeat independent, KUSP's Film Gang gives you the lowdown. You can find the complete text of these reviews updated weekly at kusp.org/film. Ask Dr. Dawn is also made possible by a grant from John F. Kennedy University's Graduate School of Professional Psychology in Campbell, offering a master's degree in counseling psychology designed for busy adults. Information available at 800-868-2359. We had a caller who couldn't stay on the air, but wanted to know, after using coffee maker, there's always residual water in the coffee machine that sits there all day. Any risks with that water? Molds, Legionnaire's disease? Okay, that's an interesting question. Basically, let's take the fact that it's boiled water. I guess it's not. It's water that boiled, but it's boiled water. It sat on the inside and recondensed and ends up down at the bottom of the thing. But it was subjected to boiling. And boiled water is pretty clean stuff. It's in a relatively sealed chamber, so there's not going to be that much chance of particulates in the atmosphere getting in there. So as long as you're using your coffee maker on a regular basis, I don't think there's much risk to that water. Legionnaire's disease requires that you inhale aerosolized particles of water that contained the Legionella bacteria. So you're generally going to see Legionnaires in cold water systems, fountains, humidifying systems, large ventilation systems in hospitals or malls have been a big issue. Fountains are a frequent source of contamination. And this is water that's not being boiled on a regular basis, and it's being aerosolized and then inhaled. So I don't think there's much risk for Legionnaire's disease or disease in general from the water in the coffee maker, just following it through logically. I wanted to take a moment and talk about the cervical cancer vaccine, which Gardasil, which is the Merck product, which finally got approved on Thursday. This is one of a couple of different vaccines. This one has that are in the works for cervical cancer. This is a vaccine against the four most commonly found dangerous forms of the human papillomavirus. When I say dangerous, I mean mutagenic. They can get into the cells, mutate them, and that can either trigger or provoke cervical cancer. And the lag time for this is about 10 years. So it's play around at 17, get your cervical cancer at 35, you know, that kind of a latency period. And human papillomavirus is very, very common. When they do surveys, they find something like 30% of the population has it. If you take it, sometimes it manifests as genital warts that can be seen. Unfortunately, those are the less dangerous strains, numbers 6 and 11, which cause warts but don't typically have an association with cervical cancers. Numbers 16 and 18, which are in the vaccine, and some of the other ones are strongly associated with cancer. That's a bad thing. But more importantly, with this vaccine, they've isolated the really dangerous ones that are most commonly found, done a vaccine against it. And if you vaccinate a girl before she has sexual activity, you can reduce her lifetime risk of cervical cancer. You can't take it to zero. There are other viruses out there which are not as strongly associated, but they're somewhat associated. You aren't going to get the risk down to zero. But we could turn cervical cancer, we've already turned cervical cancer into a rare disease by doing pap smears every year. But some people still get infected and have to have their cervix frozen or have to have it lasered. Regular surveillance allows us to catch most cases of cervical cancer before they're actually cancer at the precancerous stages nowadays. To have a vaccine that actually makes the person immune to the cancer-causing virus is a hugely beneficial thing. It's sort of a holy grail in medicine, a cancer vaccine. This isn't a perfect vaccine, but I think it will be widely used. It's going to cost about $360 retail to vaccinate an individual. And it will prevent about 70% of the potential cervical cancer. So that might save us something like 7,000 cases of cervical cancer a year. But when you start doing the math, it's going to be a very expensive proposition to vaccinate the population. I think it's going to be widely used. I think it's a good thing that it's going to be widely used. There's controversy about whether it's perfect, whether the virus, and it isn't. There is a question of whether or not if you vaccinate someone who's already infected, you might interfere with the development of their immune system against the thing they've already got and maybe predispose them. So like I said, I'm going to be aiming it at my people who aren't sexually active. Let's go now to John in Carmel. Hello, John. Welcome to the show.
Dr. Don?
Hi.
Hi. Do you ever listen to AM radio these days?
Not very much, no.
Well, I think there's a thing now, definitely a thing called radio rage. And I hadn't been listening for a long time, and couldn't believe, to AM radio, that is, and I couldn't believe how it's descended into real name-calling. On the left, I heard the other day, I won't identify who the host was, but he called Ann Coulter, this now infamous gal on the right, called her a slut a whole bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly thought, it wasn't that long ago when nobody on any show, on any radio station, would have used that word.
Mm-hmm.
And now, probably hardly anybody noticed, and I generally wouldn't have, except for the thought suddenly occurring to me that that word has gotten just common usage now on these shows. I mean, it's almost every host, with a few exceptions, seems to have descended into that.
Well, you have an, I think you have a kind of, I don't want to say Darwinian process, because it's not, there's no reproduction involved, but there is a selective pressure to get down and dirty on AM radio. Absolutely. And it's been there for years. And it has to do with the fact that you are rewarded for listeners. People tune in. The more outraged they are, the more likely they are to tune in again to see how much more outrageous this person can get. That adds to the listenership. Since you're being paid by sponsors for the number of ears, the more people who are listening, even if they're listening to be shocked or listening to be outraged, or just listening because they can't believe what they're hearing, which I think may be the phenomenon. But it's a bit like slowing down to look at a traffic accident. There's this sort of impulse that we have to slow down to look at the traffic accident, smell our own farts. We're attracted to the unwholesome. I don't understand quite why that is. But this mechanism has been amped up by the way the capital and the way the payment system is structured. And nobody really wants to listen to, you know, interesting, intelligent programming on just to learn something, which is why I kind of got off of AM radio and went to, because that's where I started out. But I was like the only person who was polite, and it was getting kind of old to be the only person who was polite. And furthermore, I wasn't getting hot numbers because I wasn't shocking people. And it's like, you know, this is a ridiculous system. This is not making any sense. It doesn't fit with me. So get out. But the people who are with whom it fits, that's what happens. Specific medical question or just a commentary?
No, I do have a medical question, too. I quit eating chocolate for a while and then went back to it, but I still catch myself every time I read the nutrition facts. You see that high saturated fat for most chocolate, and as I understand it, it comes from the cocoa butter. What some people insist that since there's usually lecithin in chocolate, that it sort of cancels out the bad effects of the cocoa butter. But when you look at those high figures, like it's 7 grams per serving, usually sometimes 8 or 9, it's very high. What's your opinion about the fat that is generally in chocolate, especially the chocolate bars?
Let's do the math, okay? 7 grams of saturated fat, you multiply by 11 calories per gram, you end up with 77 calories of saturated fat. You want, to, as a goal, to keep the saturated fat in your diet at no more than 15% and 10% as a goal, okay? So if you're a male, let's say you're on maintenance and you're not very active, you might have 2,100 calories or 2,400 calories a day to spend, which gives you, if you're shooting for 10%, 240 calories of saturated fat. So when you eat that chocolate bar and consume that 7 grams, you've used 30% of your saturated fat budget. Okay, you spent it, which means that you don't want to use butter. You want to have only lean cuts of meat, no bologna, no pizza with sausage. You want to maybe reduce your cheese, because cheese is high in saturated fat for that day. And you try to come in at or under budget on the saturated fat. So you have to compensate in what else you eat. Chocolate has a lot of good stuff in it. I mean, the antioxidant potential of an ounce of dark chocolate is like, I don't know, something on the order of 5 cups of broccoli. It's insanely good as an antioxidant, and it's probably a good idea to have an ounce of dark chocolate a day just for the flavonoids and the antioxidant potential that it contains. But you've got to subtract it off of your saturated fat budget. So I am a big advocate of balance. You know, let's not get irrational. Let's try not to get irrational in line with the previous discussion. Let's actually try to use the brains, at least 10% of them that we're walking around with. And, you know, you can do some simple math and figure out, okay, well, if I'm going to go with the chocolate, that means I need low fat mozzarella cheese on my sandwich rather than a high fat cheese. You balance it. That's what I think is the healthiest approach.
Thank you. I appreciate your answer.
Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. One more thing about cocoa butter, which is controversial, and I have not yet formed an opinion, but there are people in the biochemistry world who say that a saturated fat that comes from a plant source like cocoa butter may not be nearly as unfriendly to your arteries as a saturated fat that's coming from an animal source like lard. So stay tuned on that one as the biochemistry and the science clarifies itself. I'll try to get back to you with a more definitive answer. Let's go now to August in Capitola. Hello, August. You're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Dawn. Thanks for taking my call. And thanks for any good news about chocolate.
Yeah, I usually get some compliments for that one.
Yeah. Now, my question is concerning water quality. I've been talking with my local water quality technician here about contaminants in our water system. And his major concern at the moment is microcontaminants, which are not actually listed in our water quality surveys at this time. And his concern is that he's finding that microcontaminants, things we've been washing down the drain into our cleanup systems, our treatment systems, are showing powerful levels of hormonal disruptors.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. So, and I've seen a long list of things that I've been used to washing down the sink, like washing my paintbrushes out when I'm working with acrylics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm finding, I could talk to him, I said, what do I do instead? He said, well, the best thing to do is pour your water into a pan and let it evaporate and then take that and take it to the hazardous waste site. That's how dangerous it's looking. Now, do you feel that it's that scary? And what does a hormonal disruptor mean to our system, to us and to the other wildlife, especially those frogs are very sensitive to these?
Well, amphibians and fish, and there's just tons of data that support this, are showing signs of feminization.
Mm-hmm.
And that, obviously, if you have all females, you don't get too much reproduction going on.
Yeah.
And so the concern is that we could affect the food chain eventually by causing all the fish to be feminized, and then they don't spawn, and then we don't get baby fish, and that could be, of course, like putting all of the fish on the planet on birth control pills.
It'd be better if we put all the humans on the planet on birth control pills.
Well, yes, I'm not arguing that point.
No, I'm sorry. It just occurred to me that if I were doing a trade-out, I'd trade it out.
Yeah. No, so And the idea is, actually, if you go back into the archives, I think there's a question way back, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, a discussion of hormone disruptors on one of the programs. And, you know, you don't have to go dig for it. I'll recap it for you here. But there's two issues, one of which is that a lot of these things, dioxin being the classic example, but phthalates, which came up recently, it's a softener used in plastics, it's in nail polish. Every time I put nail polish on and then eat something with my fingers, I'm eating some of that nail polish, so I'm getting some phthalates in my system. There's been a study in humans that showed that if the mothers, when they're pregnant, have a high phthalate level, if you measure it, and then you measure the distance between the base of the penis and the opening of the anus in their boy babies that are born, there's basically a shortening of that distance depending on, and correlates nicely with the phthalate level in the mother's bloodstream. So the idea is that we're actually affecting the way the genitals form in the male infant, depending upon the level of these plastic derivatives in the bloodstream of the mother. Now, so far, there's really no evidence that anal genital distance affects fertility. But, you know, we have seen globally a decline in fertility in Western countries in terms of the sperm. And, you know, could there be a connection? Well, you bet there could be. The answer to a could there be question is always yes. And the next question is, okay, well, what's, you know, how likely is it? And that's an open question. I don't think we have enough data to answer it. We certainly have enough data to say that we've created chemicals, we've distributed them in the environment. The cat is out of the bag. These compounds are in the environment, and they're having effects on the environment, and particularly in the lower organisms. Now, the next question is, what do we do about that, and what is feasible to do about that? And I think that let's start with drugs. Let's start with birth control pills. Let's start with what's practical to do. Now, I'm not going to ask all the women on the planet who are on birth control pills not to pee into the toilet, because that eventually ends up in the ocean. You know, it goes through sewage treatment, but the sewage treatment doesn't remove the hormones, so we're basically ending up with increasing amounts of hormones in the sewage system in the ocean because of people taking birth control pills. Mm. We are part of an ecology. We will impact the ecology. The ecology impacts us. That's a rule of biology. So what's prudent? Well, for one thing, don't flush anything down the toilet that you can put in a landfill. So don't flush old pills. Take the pills, put them in a plastic bag, put the plastic bag in a landfill, and let's bury it and let it sit there in a sort of inert environment that's much less likely to make it into, it's a sequestration. It's not perfect, but it definitely is walling it off in a better way. You know, burning it, you know, has some problems because we release a lot of stuff when we burn it.
And so we breathe it.
Yeah, so the best move is to bury it and try to sequester it. And we know the sequestration's not perfect, but we hope that Gia and the mother will filter a lot of this stuff as she absorbs it into her earth substance, that by the time it actually gets into the water table, a lot of this will have been broken down by microorganisms and will have been rendered harmless. Because thank goodness the planet is smarter than we are,
mm-hmm.
and we'll deal with a lot of these things given half a chance. But we want to keep the stuff out of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the idea of letting your acrylic paint think evaporate, you could do that. You could also have a place, you know, just a hole in the ground where you poured it.
You know, I asked him about that, and he said that his current data was that's not such a good idea.
Because
I asked him about that.
It's not such a great idea, but it's probably better than down the sink.
Yes, he said, well, actually, no. At this point, he said, rather than putting that into the ground, he said it would be better to put those through the wastewater processing.
I don't know.
At this point. And then again, that's his opinion point.
I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's data-based.
His preferred method would be evaporation to the residue and then taking the residue and disposing of it, as you suggested, with pills.
Right.
Let it go to the landfill.
Yeah, and that, to me, seems a more rational approach.
Contain
but,
it. Yeah. The other issue that comes up around this is the usefulness of composting toilets properly employed.
I don't know enough about that technology to say what you... I mean, I know it gets rid of the dangerous bacterial wastes, mm-hmm. but I'm not quite sure about chemicals.
Neither am I. That's why I wondered if you had any information.
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'll try to find something out, but... You know, the problem with this is right now you've got the true believers who are fanatics. And, you know, their information is suspect because they're kind of fanatical and they're selective about what they put on their websites and what they publish. And then you've got the real scientists who are so conservative, and it's very frustrating because they don't like to even, you know, they won't lay down a qualitative statement until they've got an overwhelming amount of data. And it's expensive and difficult to get that data. So you float around with all these questions going, you know, how scared should I be and what's the right thing to do? But
what the right thing to do is I think what most of us want to know, what is the right thing to do?
Yes, and I think in terms of just what I can tell you concretely, don't flush drugs down the toilet. Mm-hmm. Think in terms of when you're rinsing something that's toxic, trying to keep it out of the ocean. And since everything around here goes into a wastewater system, unless you have a septic system.
Right.
You know, I have a septic system, so basically, and it's south of my vegetable garden.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, well, then the other thing that is the storm drain. The storm drains. People have been cautioned against washing cars on the street, pouring solvents on the street, which people used to do.
Right.
Without
thinking about it.
And now that all ends up right in the bay.
All right, well, thank you for the call and the heads
thank
up.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Terry in Carmel. Hello, Terry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about human identical hormones that I have been taking for I don't know if it's the same as bioidentical, but I've been taking them for 3 years, and I'm wondering always about the safety of continuing, and I read articles about... hormone research, and I don't know if the research is about, you know, human identical hormones or if they're a different form of hormones. So I'm not, I'd like to know where I can go to get the latest information on research and how safe they are now, because I know it's always kind of changing.
Well, okay. Safety in the bioidentical hormone issue,
mm-hmm.
the idea, when that term is used, it always or should always apply to human identical.
Okay.
So that's, you know, that's one thing. is what we're talking about, is human identical
right.
stuff.
Okay. Yes, that's what I am talking about. Estradiol, I think it's considered human identical.
Yes.
Okay. And the safety of it as far as, you know, possibly getting breast cancer from it, what is the latest research is what I'm wanting to find out, or where to go to find that, because I read articles and I don't know if the research is being done on human identical hormones or something else.
The research is being done on human identical hormones if they use the word bioidentical.
Okay. Well, these articles don't even say, this one that I read, it was an April issue in Newsweek, didn't mention if it was bioidentical or not. They said it could increase ovarian cancer, breast cancer. And I just, you know, I just don't know where to go to get information on what the latest research is on.
Well, I have some bad news for you there, Terry, because there isn't a single authoritative source
mm-hmm.
where everybody agrees, yes, this is the authority and this is the best research. It's definitely a moving target.
Okay.
As far as ovarian cancer is concerned, the ovarian cancer issue, in my opinion, at least, has more to do with your own ovarian function. It's
mm-hmm.
not very normal to have ovaries that are functioning for 35 years, you know, mm-hmm. for a full fertility period. What's normal, what we're built for, is to be pregnant for 50% of the time when we're between 15 and 35.
Mm-hmm.
And we aren't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we use birth control, or we use other forms, we use birth control pills or other forms of contraception. But if we use other forms of contraception, then our ovaries are cycling during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so as our ovaries cycle, we end up with a situation where they're being driven to divide. That creates more ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That creates more ovarian cancer than we would normally expect to see.
Mm-hmm.
So if you give hormones that reduce the amount of activity in the ovary, you're going to actually improve the ovarian cancer rate. Breast cancer is a different story. Breast cancer, when we use artificial hormones after a period of time when we would biologically not have them in our bodies, which
mm-hmm.
is to say postmenopausally,
right.
the breasts receive more stimulation. See, when you give hormones, the ovaries shut down, but the breasts perk up. So it's an
mm-hmm.
opposite effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm much more concerned about potentially creating more of a breast cancer because the breasts are in a more metabolically active state, more
mm-hmm.
cells are dividing, and guess what? Every time the cells divide, there's a chance for cancer to occur.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like giving Miracle-Grow to the weeds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're stimulating them, so there's more opportunity for it to grow. Interestingly enough, estrogen after menopause appears to create better, more differentiated, less aggressive breast cancers. So, you know, not that we want to give people breast cancers, but the breast cancers they get tend to be less aggressive than the ones that women who aren't taking hormones get.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more of them. So, what are you going to do? Breast
yeah.
cancer does not generally kill you. Osteoporosis is a big reason to be on hormones.
I have a family history of.
Yeah, and women who have physiological symptoms at menopause shouldn't feel guilty about using hormones. But I think it's, you know, it's along the lines of you do something, you may have a price to pay. There is no absolute safety in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that probably the most dangerous thing to do is non-biologically identical hormones,
mm-hmm.
things like the progestin that we use, the progestin medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is Provera, actually has some testosterone-like activity. And we know giving testosterone to women postmenopausally is an unnatural thing to do. It maybe makes them horny, which might be worth the risk, but there is a risk involved and increases
mm-hmm.
their risk of heart disease very clearly, and
yeah.
maybe breast cancer.
Okay, so there isn't any website I can go to.
There are 100 of them.
Okay.
But there's no single authority.
All
what
right.
you want is a single
yeah,
authoritative source, and there isn't
that.
One. Yeah.
It's great for you. It will have, you know, good things, and then I hear these bad things, and I'm just going, God, you know, I don't know if I want to stay on them and take the risk of... So...
go to your doctor and do an actual, you know, what are the risks, what are you worried about, what are your benefits,
mm-hmm.
and you do the benefits, and you do the cost analysis, and you make your call.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be individualized.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to go quickly to Steve, who actually has some information about juveniles in legal trouble. Hello, Steve. Thanks for staying on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Dr. Dunn. Thanks for taking my call.
We just have a couple of minutes, but I thought this was an interesting follow-up to the explosive disorder. I wanted to give you a little airtime. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I don't really have a question, but I just wanted to say that I teach anger management and juvenile detention, and I have for years. And I put together a curriculum specifically for youth in juvenile detention. And it has mixed results. I mean, some kids really get into it and they apply the skills and other kids don't. But I do have kids that periodically ask me if I'm going to be teaching it and they want to take it and they're interested in it and they want to do it. So I guess I just wanted to say that I'm out there doing it and there's probably other people out there that are trying to teach young people about how to handle their anger in a productive way.
I know that there are. It's not being done in a real systematic way, and I'd love to see some coordination of the effort, making it a bit more global rather than waiting. You know, by the time you're dealing with somebody who's a juvenile delinquent, you know, I guess that's an outmoded term, but basically by the time you're dealing with someone there, you're dealing with someone with a lot of entrenched habits and reaction patterns.
True.
It would be nice to go upstream and look at the individuals. I'm also really wondering about the familial pattern here, because if you've got a dad like that who's modeling that behavior when you're 3 years old and deciding, you know, what does it mean to be a man, you know, that could become part of your attributed behavior set for what it means to be a man, and that's not a good thing.
No, and I totally agree with you. Yeah, that's the modeling part of it is a big part of it, because it's a learned behavior, and that means it can be unlearned. So that's what we try to do, and I totally agree. I think it should be anger management or how to deal with your feelings in a nonviolent way, in a constructive way, ought to be done at an earlier age and in earlier grades.
Well, is there a program or a website you can direct people to?
No, not really.
Okay. Well,
I don't know of anything like that.
Well, if you find one, you let me know, and I'll put it out there.
Okay, great.
Thanks very much.
And thank you. Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye.
Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz, providing a full range of cardiac services close to home, including prevention, diagnosis, intervention, and rehabilitation. Dominican Hospital Cardiac Services, 462-7079. Online at DominicanHospital.org. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we'll be going in just a couple of minutes off to the auction, but we've got a little bit of Miles first, so take a big deep breath and relax.